Well, we'll get into it, but is there any geographical allocation to either one of them that's different,
US,
or is it just
all domestic US?
All domestic US.
The difference is that Zig is mid and large.
Right.
And
that's what
Deep
I thought.
Okay. Small and micro. Small.
Yeah. Perfect. Love it. All right.
You know what?
Let's lay some tape.
Yeah. Welcome back. I'm Pierre Daly, managing editor at advisoranalyst.com. And this is Raise Your Average. Co-hosting with me is Mike Philbrick, CEO at Resolve Asset Management. Mike?
Good to see you, Pierre. Toby?
Been too long, bro.
Yeah, it's great to see you, Mike. Nice to meet you, Pierre.
Yeah. Nice to meet you as well.
I can't wait to talk about something that is outperforming the S&P 500 and its concentration and all its nonsense. So I know your Zig is that the ETF at Acquirers Funds is really kind of lighting a candle these days, and it might be a sign of a regime shift, maybe a larger regime shift within, you know, stocks and asset allocation. So I'm excited to talk about that.
Look, let's hope so, because I've been a value investor my entire career, and it's been like eating glass for most of it, but it's been, I think since, I don't want to pinpoint the day, but you know that I can, but like September 2020 was really the bottom for me relatively. And it's been pretty good since then.
Amazing. Amazing.
As you can see, our special guest this episode is Tobias Carlyle. He's managing principal and chief investment officer at Acquirers Funds, LLC. Tobias is one of the most thoughtful, measured investors and a deep thinker and value investor, and brings historical perspective and humility to the art of investing, as well as being a prolific writer on the subject and study of the world's most successful investors.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of advisoranalyst.com or of our guests. This broadcast is meant to be for informational purposes only. Nothing discussed in this broadcast is intended to be considered as advice.
Toby, it's fantastic to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, that's an incredibly kind introduction. So thank you, Pierre. I'm very grateful to be here with you.
Well, I'm a little nervous to talk to this guy now. I had no idea he was that prolific.
He is, Mike. He is. Well deserved.
My friends amaze me in that sense.
Well deserved, Toby. But Toby, to kick things off, for those who aren't familiar with you, don't know you, tell us a little bit about the arc of your career and what inspired you to get into investing in the first place, and some of the unique ways that you approach investing. I know that that's a bit loaded of a starter.
No, that's great. That's it. Thank you for that. I run an ETF firm in Los Angeles, California, and we have two ETFs, Zig, which is a large and mid cap. Actually, having said that, the holdings have, and we can talk about this a little bit later on, but the holdings have come in quite a lot from, it's been a funny sort of period of time. The holding size, the median holding size has come in from sort of mid large to really it's almost a small cap ETF at the moment, but its universe is mid and large. It's just that when we're trying to buy the cheapest, best value, you know, highest quality, whatever we're trying to do, that has just forced us into this sort of smaller world as everything's gone up in price. And then Deep is a small and micro ETF. Deep has 100 holdings. Zig has 30 holdings. The difference is because the smaller companies are more illiquid, harder to trade, but also because they just tend to be, the businesses aren't as great. And so we're trying to have as much exposure to each. They're both actively managed, but they follow a very strict rules-based process that I have written about in a series of books. One of them is Quantitative Value that I wrote with, he was a PhD student at Booth and it came out in 2012. And we studied every bit of industry and academic research that we could find, including some papers that went back to the 1930s, to see if they still continue to work today. And then we had some very new stuff at the time. I guess it's old now, but Novi Marks with that gross profits total assets paper. We tested all of that stuff. And so we used the Novi Marks paper to build a slightly better magic formula. We were just doing some fun stuff in there. And then subsequently, I've written several other books, Deep Value, which came out in 2014, Concentrated Investing, which came out in 2016, and The Acquirer's Multiple, which is a shorter, easier book to read that came out in 2017. And I've contributed to some other stuff as well. But the thrust has always been to test the research, find out what works, put it together into a model, and then use that model to buy stocks. So there are lots of arguments for being quantitative or otherwise. I think that to deliver the, make sure that we're delivering what people expect us to deliver, I think quant approach is the best way of doing that, because I've seen enough guys in this business who, particularly value investors, who get a little bit behind, size up a position, they just drift a little bit towards what's working, which is fatal in this business, because really what you have to do is pursue your strategy, whatever happens, because every strategy has good times and bad times. And if you abandon it in the bad times, then you miss out on those good times. So you have to stay in whatever you're doing. But it can be tough because, you know, the back test runs up to some period of time, then you start live implementation of it, and all of a sudden it's not working, and you panic because you think, well, maybe it didn't work, maybe it never worked, there was something about it. And value in particular has sort of had this argument since it stopped working. It depends on, we all have slightly different measuring points where we think it stopped working, but say 2010 at the earliest probably, through to 2020, 21, maybe something like that, which is incredibly long. That's a big chunk of a career to stay invested in something that doesn't seem to be working that well. And then I was fortunate on that over that period of time, because I was talking to so many, I have a podcast, I was talking to so many people over that period, and I encountered a lot of value investors that I would take lots of guys who had some stuff that was working, and it was the growthier guys who were, you know, in the names that probably weren't traditional value names. It's not to say that it's not value, it's just that their method of investment was to assume a lot of growth, which typically value investors don't do. And there's good reasons for that, because it hasn't, growth hasn't been a great predictor of forward returns, as funny as that sounds. But I could take any idea that I got from these guys, and I could go back to the system, and I could test it, and I could see, has this worked historically? Is this in fact a better approach? And what I found was that they all tended to work in times that were like the time that we were in 2020, 2021, which was a time that was very growthy, and they didn't work outside of those periods of time. And so I found a gentleman by the name of Mikhail Samanov. He'd done this research project where he had knitted together three data sets that gave him 200 years of value data. So the first data set is that one that we all use, which is the one that begins in about 1926, which is the French data. And then he used the Cowles Commission data, which was the one that Benjamin... Cowles did this... He had this question, are there any investors out there who have any skill? And I think he was talking about newsletter writers, and he took their ideas and he stuck them into these punch cards, early sort of computer. And he used some data from 1875 to 1925. And that was the data that Benjamin Graham used to say, oh, I think that you get about 15% a year using like a low price to book type approach. And then the most recent, the oldest set of data, which started in something like 1825 and ran to 1875, I guess, was some guys had found all of the old annual reports or any sort of financial reporting that they could. And it was very limited reporting. You know, there were no balance sheets. There were no cash flow statements. There was nothing like that. It was very, very simple stuff. And they looked at dividend yield, because that was the only thing that you could indicate whether it was value or not. And so the higher dividend yields they imputed as value, and the low dividend yield or the no dividend yield was imputed as growth. And they found the same thing. And so he knitted these three data sets together, and he said there have been these periods of value underperformance, and they've all clustered around sort of tech innovations. And the first one began in something like 1825, which was when Cornelius Vanderbilt had the steam engine, and then there was the telegraph, which was the first information technology, because prior to that, information had traveled between England and the US, at the speed of the wind that blew the ship over. And so finally they laid a cable between the two, and all of a sudden that was their first information technology revolution. Or maybe it wasn't the first, maybe it was a scribe.
The wheel was the first, yeah, wheel. Then the boat.
But around all of these little, and you can go back and it's quite funny to see them, because there's, you know, there was a Great Depression before the Great Depression. We've renamed that original Great Depression the Long Depression, because the Great Depression was greater than the Great Depression. But there are all of these sort of periods, and it's kind of fascinating to go back and see how often it's happened. And so it gave me some confidence that what we were going through was cyclical. We should stay with what we're doing, which I think is really the key. You have to be consistent. And I think that being systematic or quantitative gives you that consistency. You do lose some things, doesn't quite dig into the financial statements as much. It may not understand the business and the forward prospects. That's always the argument. You're looking backwards. You can't see the future.
Right.
To which I always say, everybody's looking backwards. Nobody can see the future. It's just that I'm using quantitative data rather than sort of supposition. And my method is replicable. No matter how stressed the markets are or how stressed I am, I can keep on implementing this. And it did seem to turn around, and it has done a little bit better since. So that's a very long-winded answer. I apologize. That's the approach.
I think that the idea of a systematic approach, yeah, is just codifying what you're going to do in the different situations. And if you're not codifying it, is it a framework in your head? You know, certainly Charlie Munger and Warren had some mental frameworks, and they're famous for sharing those. And they had pretty disciplined rigor around them, even though they didn't codify them into maybe code or some rigorous set of rules. And I think, you know, you've touched on some really great topics. Like, how are you going to have the discipline if you're just trusting the wetware in your head, if you don't know the history?
Right.
And 10 years of an out of favor, 15 years of an out of favor factor, it's nothing. I mean, we operate in the future space. Trend has gone through that. If you look at the NASDAQ having, you know, a 14, 15 year bear market, like growth has its day in the doghouse as well as the penthouse. And if you don't have the ability to stick with it when the bullets are flying and you're sitting in the foxhole, then you end up absorbing the risk with no potential for return.
Right.
And if you don't know the character and the time frame, and I think Meb talks about this all the time too, it's like, right, you got to have a 20-year time frame. If you're investing, you really should be thinking 20 years. 5 years is just nonsensical, actually. You're just getting caught up in random noise. So, you know, to be able to survive those bad times, to actually capture the factor that you're trying to harness above whatever market beta, you need to know the factor that you're after. You need to be able to weather the bad times so you don't absorb all the risk and then get none of the subsequent returns. And then, you know, as you said, there's this sneaky little things that happens with the managers. The managers that survive, often their system gets bastardized by whatever, you know, sort of tweaks need to be done in order to survive. And so you lose the true character over time if you're not employing some sort of systematic design, that you are just, you know, groundhog daying the crap out of. And so kudos to you for surviving. Hopefully we have seen the turn.
it's an ideological debate, right? I mean, this value versus growth debate has become this ideological argument. And you know, I think you made a great point, which is that, you know, everybody can agree on process. How important having a set of rules are, even an algorithm, you know, so that you do stay pure and stick to your basis for investing, because it is so easy, emotionally, behaviorally, to get caught up and make those mistakes that, you know, as you pointed out as well, that a lot of value investors made and, you know, blew themselves up or you know, got called out for style drift and didn't, you know, either didn't stick to their knitting or, you know, they had a lot of unhappy investors because it looked like they didn't know what they were doing anymore. And then, you know, when investors lose faith and move on, you know, it's over. But as long as you've got that set of rules that you can stick to, you can still make that constant argument for why it's important to stick with your knitting, to stick to your guns.
Or they hug the benchmark, right? As a means of survival, right? As a pure means of survival, you start to hug the benchmark because, you got to eat. And at the same time, what an incredible opportunity if if you're an asset manager in value or trend, it gets a little hard in those times. It gets a little lean. But if you're someone who has cash flows from other businesses and is saving for the long term, when do you want to save and accumulate assets? Well, in a market cap sense, you want to be saving in the 70s in preparation for the 1982 to 1990 bull market. You want to be saving through the knots in anticipation of the 2014 to 2021 run. Like, that's when you want to be accumulating assets. So few people do that. And now, you're at the hopefully, or, maybe the verge of a regime shift in the way things are going, and maybe an anticipation of more returns that are not so crowded in a market cap weighted sense. So maybe, Tobias, where do you want to go from here? A question that comes to my mind is, in Zig, you've highlighted some of the market capitalization differences that you're truly adding diversification to anyone who's got a market cap portfolio. Do you want to go down the path of, are there any other differences that you want to point out that are truly differentiating and adding value to someone's market cap exposure? Or is there some other ways you want to go? Because I know you were on kind of this historical path with technological revolution leading to some of these funny dislocations, which I think is a fascinating conversation too. Well, so I don't want to cut that off.
One of the challenges with value is that the idea, it sounds like it should be an evergreen idea that you buy something for less than it's worth. The challenge with value is that you're buying something, you're saying to people you're going to buy something for less than it's worth. And that sounds like an evergreen idea that I'll go out and we're going to buy these things that are undervalued. Mean reversion says we'll get back to value. That sounds like it should work all the time. And if you ask a lot of value investors, that's what they'll say. Like, it's not a cyclical strategy. It's an evergreen strategy. The reality is, though, in its implementation, it does seem that when you pay higher prices, the discount needs to be quite wide, and it doesn't really make sense sometimes that even though that you can look at the prices that we were paying in 2015, which I think is one of the worst years for performance, and it didn't seem to me that they were outrageous prices to be paying for value at that time. It's just that growth had got so crushed from the poor performance coming out of the dot-com. It was 15 years of, and the dot-com, many people characterize the dot-com boom as this sort of internet boom, but really what it was a large growth boom. And so many of the companies that Microsoft, Walmart, not a tech company at all, GE had its idiosyncratic problems, but those sort of companies were emblematic of the 1990s that they had this phenomenal run. And they continued to be, maybe with GE as an exception, but the rest of them continued to be very, very good businesses, compounded their earnings streams through the 15 years from 2000 to 2015. Stock prices went nowhere. And so they got into 2015, still phenomenal businesses, very depressed multiples. And the difference between the cheap stocks and the expensive stocks wasn't much. The spread was the narrowest it has ever been. And subsequent to that, growth went on a great tear and value suffered miserably through that period of time. Even though I would still characterize those value portfolios, pretty good portfolios, they weren't too expensive. So that it's something that exists slightly outside, and it speaks to the unpredictability of this business. And it's one of the reasons why I think probably the best approach is to have this. If you know nothing and you expect everything in the future, you should have some allocation to all of these different strategies. Value has suffered because it hasn't had a great return. And I know that endowments and other big organizations have cut their value exposure because they want to get more exposure to private equity or other things that have been working, which I think is a bad idea, because right now we're in this place where we've gone back to value being at a very widespread relative to the growthier names. So what we provide is something akin to, my focus has always been this sort of value approach that's something like a private equity approach. It's very faddish and common to say that, but we really do use the same sort of multiple, the same mechanic as those private equity firms. And so we find ourselves in the ideal business is something that tends to be a little bit smaller. It tends to be generating quite a lot of cash flow. It's got a management team that is doing something about those cash flows. So they're buying back stock or they're reinvesting at a higher return on invested capital than you can get outside of the market. So the internal rates of reinvestment and the distributions mean that collectively it should generate pretty good returns over the long term. We rebalance consistently towards those things. The only promise that I can make is that we are going to do that come hell or high water. And as evidence for that, I would say that that was what we did through a period of time where it didn't work. And then we turned the corner and it does seem to have worked. And I think that last year was a pretty good year, even though I don't think it was a great year for value. It was a pretty good year for us. We've sort of continued on through the first quarter, although the growth year stocks have been quite strong. We were strong. It's just that relatively we were probably not as strong as some of the growth year stocks. We were still a sort of a 9% first quarter, which is, compounds out at a very high rate and is much, much higher than I would expect over the long run. So I think that we are consistent and we have an unusual approach that will mean that we do have some idiosyncratic performance that maps pretty closely to value. So I think we're a good bet for those reasons.
I also like the fact that the overlap is non-existent from the standpoint of what most people own, the S&P 500. Mm-hmm. So if you're truly going to diversify, diversify your bag, if you will, if you add something like an acquirer's multiple type of acquirer fund, where you're looking at these values, certainly in the micro cap space would be no overlap, but in your mid cap / large cap, which as you said, skews to more small or large at the moment, truly you're getting diversification in the names that you own, the approach right. you're taking, the multiples you're paying, and thus, gives you the opportunity for that rebalancing as well. So if you've got an allocation and it's, underperforming even, that's the opportunity to be adding in those decades where, there's underperformance for the potential outperformance. So it's always amuses me that, there's a lot of certainly attention paid to the discipline that institutions bring to their allocation process. But at the same time, those management teams do turn over and they face the same challenges with respect to job security versus the performance in the short term of their various endowments and pension funds. So they are subject to the herding and the allocation of everyone else. And they do make mistakes along the way, over allocating to overpopular areas and under allocating to diversifying areas, kind of as a regular occurrence. I think with the Murder on the Orient by Charles Ellis, that article sort of highlights that whole point. So it's not like institutions are immune to this. They're run by humans as well. And it probably comes back to, the idea of having some very rigorous rules around how you make these selections and whatnot. Any other tips for how you get through these periods as a value guy, or how do you continue to explain to the individual investors to keep them disciplined, to keep them allocating to, because I'm sure we're going to be talking to a number of registered investment advisors, both across Canada and the US. And, one of their problems is always, gosh, how do I get this line item? Now you've overcome that in Zig, certainly for the last year. It's been a nice line item to have in diversifying and outperforming. But, those times don't always work like that. So is there any kind of tricks of the trade that you help those who are allocating, whether they be advisors or institutions, work through the mental challenges of sticking to it?
Well, it's only in a secondhand sense, in that I think to be a good value investor, to be a good investor, full stop, but I'm only a value investor, so I can only think in those terms. The great challenge is the behavioral biases and cognitive errors that we all make. And that's the that's what quantitative, that's the byline on quantitative value, which I have here, is automating intelligent investment and eliminating behavioral errors. And that's not that I'm trying to push that too hard. That's an old book, but that's something that has always been a concern of mine. I'm a lawyer by training. I started in Australia and I worked in San Francisco. I did mergers and acquisitions and corporate advisory. That's my background. And we just did a lot of private equity by virtue of that's what was the turn of the, you know, from the end of the dot-com boom, that early 2000s was all private equity. That was all that anybody wanted to do. And so that was where my experience was. And so I saw a lot of these private equity firms doing these acquisitions of these businesses, and it's a nightmare. You got to paper. There's a lot of paper. There's a capital stack, and there's so much stuff that goes into one of those acquisitions. And then they don't work. Has to all be unpicked on the other side. It's a tough thing to do. And at the same time, I could see on the stock market, there are companies that were trading for cheaper than these guys were paying in these negotiated transactions. And I thought, well, if, you know, ceteris paribus, everything being equal, you're going to get better returns buying a portion of these things. The theory of it, I think, is very sound. But as you point out, the implementation of it is the real challenge, because when you go to buy these things, you know, there's a reason why every single company gets cheap. It's because they have an obvious problem. And you either have to ignore that obvious problem and assume that it solves itself, or figure out how it gets solved, which is why I like activism as a sort of, I'm not an activist, but I have a great admiration for a lot of what the good activists will do, where they'll find these companies and they'll make those changes to the balance sheet or make those changes operationally for whatever they need.
Toby, you shared an interesting story on a recent podcast that you did with Justin Carboneau and Jack Forehand. And you talked about Warren Buffett very subtly pressuring Vicky Golub at Oxy,
right,
to return capital as a mode of return from an acquisition. And you told a similar story, which I thought was really interesting, about BNSF, the Burlington Northern acquisition by Buffett. Maybe talk about that just as exemplaries of what you look at or what interests you in terms of how other modes of return from investment.
Well, every stock has two sources of return. One is the yield and one is the reinvestment rate. And you can take both of those and turn them into a perpetuity and sum them together. And that's essentially the way Buffett thinks about it, I think. You want to get as much of your cost base back as you can, as quickly as you can. And then what remains, you want that to be compounding at as high a rate as you possibly can. One of the obvious, easy ways of doing that is making sure that they don't hoard a whole lot of capital, that, you know, some of these companies let the cash build up on the balance sheet. And one good example of that was Apple. Remember Apple, before Einhorn and Icahn got involved, had a huge cash holding on its balance sheet relative to,
right,
to the size of the business. And Einhorn had this idea for iPrefs, he called it, where it was going to be a preference share. It was a complicated kind of model, probably overly complicated. Icahn just came in and said, just buy back a whole lot of stock. So I think there was one of Icahn's sort of more restrained activist campaigns. But it still stirs up some bad feelings. You know, there's still some pushback. And I just think that the kind of genius of Buffett's approach is that he doesn't do either of those things. He doesn't go in and lobby for them to do any of that stuff. He doesn't harass them or anything like that. He waits until after the fact, when they started buying back stock. And he writes in every single one of his letters that the stock buybacks that Apple does contributes materially to the performance of Berkshire Hathaway. And so he's got this sort of, he gets them to do what he wants them to do by saying that this is what they've already said. And the example of the one that I gave was Oxy with Vicky Golub, where, yes, he took one of their slides from their presentation and he put it up in his own Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting, and he said, look, this is the slide where they said they were going to be returning capital, and this is why we bought the stock. And so, you know, the implication is keep on returning the capital, which I thought was really clever, because it seems like he's supporting them, but really what he's saying is, you know, this is why we're here, don't mess this up. So I think that that's been, activists have this have this bad reputation. You know, Buffett is originally an activist. He's a corporate raider. He's
right.
He doesn't like the bad feelings that it stirs up. And I feel the same way. I don't want, you know, that it takes a certain type Uncle of personality.
Warren, you know, good old Uncle Warren. He's so, he's shy, isn't it? Total corporate raider, but such a nice guy. It's Warren, yeah. Grandpa
but
Warren.
People don't like it. Yeah. So he's just said, well, I'm not going to do it in that way. And I think that that's a fair approach. You're allowed to expect a certain, you know, as in business, you're allowed to expect that people do what they say they're going to do, and you're allowed to hold them accountable for that. But that sort of the litigators who go after the ambulance chasing litigators and some of the activists, like that's a really obnoxious way of living your life and doing business. And you need to be someone who can inflict psychic pain and not absorb it. And those personalities exist. I'm not
sure. Like so Nelson Peltz.
Right. Exactly.
Nelson Peltz and Bob Iger. Yeah.
They can do that stuff. But I don't want to be anywhere near that, even though I do like some of the impact that they have on the stocks that I own. So I'm in that world of, I'm not close to those people, but I'm close to those stocks. And that's sort of where I'm trying to, there's either going to be some foment from a private equity firm or for an activist because they're cheap, they have a problem. The problem's going to be resolved either by the management team or externally. And the market can't see when it will happen, but everybody kind of knows that it has to happen. And so that's why, that's the sort of stuff that I like being in, because the thing that seems to be a problem for most investors is that patience is waiting around for it. And so I say, well, I'm going to hold a portfolio. There's going to be enough activity in the portfolio that I'm not going to be too worried about any individual name. And so I can just let it run. And I think it's a good strategy, and it has proved to be in live trading as well.
Is there any examples currently that you can highlight in the portfolio that would, serve as examples?
Do I have any at the moment that at the moment, I think the portfolio looks like it's quite a cyclical, commodity-driven portfolio at the moment.
That, yeah.
And that's delivered a lot of the returns. But, you know, there's stuff like we'll own Met Coal. So we have a Met Coal company, Warrior Met. A lot of people don't feel good about coal because they think that it's got some connection to climate change. I would say that if you look at the spending bill, the Inflation Reduction Act out of the US, that's going to be directed towards a lot of green energy and a lot of those sort of projects that needs a lot of steel. If you need steel, you need met coal. And so that's there's huge demand for this. And on that's the demand side. The supply side is that there are no new coal mines being built. There's right. very limited supply. And so you can have a look at the charts on those things. They've really started performing quite well, and they're completely underowned and orphaned, even though the stock charts are starting to look pretty impressive for those things. So that's the kind of thing. We go off the beaten path, find stuff that's unusual. It's genuine.
This was the thinking behind the Glencore acquisition of Teck as well, was it not?
Of Teck Resources?
Teck Resources, metallurgical coal.
Likely, yeah. I'm not familiar with that in particular, but likely.
Yeah, behind the scenes of that Teck acquisition was Glencore wanting to corner some supply as a result of Teck's involvement. I mean, it wasn't obvious, but it was there, and it was definitely a component of the deal. But it sort of resonates with what you just said.
It doesn't necessarily, the expression of it right now in the portfolio isn't necessarily always the way that it will be expressed in the portfolio. So I was a tech investor in the 2000s. And I don't know if people sort of
Said, yeah, you know, I said tech and I didn't say Tech Resources.
No, I did know that you meant TECK. Yeah. I didn't know exactly, what you're talking about, but I just meant, I have actually held TECK as well, but I mean, the expression, the portfolio at the moment is cyclical commodities, and that's not always the way that the portfolio will be. The portfolio will be into whatever is sort of way too cheap for what it's doing. And in the mid 2000s, tech got very, very uncool for a long period of time there, and they had good recurring cash flows and they were cheap. And so I was a tech investor, And that was when people used to complain about the life, the lifetime of tech being too short because the technology was, and nobody would touch it because Buffett had said, "I'm not a tech investor." Nobody went anywhere near any of that stuff. And I think Apple was the thing that finally tipped for value guys that they could say, "Oh, here's a pretty, it's a good recurring business. It's got a lot of cash flow." And then everybody became a technology investor. But and I'm sure that that will happen again in the future. I'm sure that we'll all be value investors back in tech. But that's the sector weightings are sort of, it's never going to be fixed. It's always going to be a different sector. When oil traded at a negative number, those oil companies all got very, very cheap. And there was this, nobody really believed that oil was going to trade negatively for any extended period of time, but oil companies got very cheap, and they've all sort of, now they're expensive. So we were oil investors for a little while, now we're not oil investors. And that's the nature of value, is that is a little bit of a movable feast. And that's why I think you need to be a generalist particularly, and quant helps with that too.
So yeah, great point, Toby. And I think that let's walk through some of how you go from screens to the portfolio construction. And just as an anecdote, right, you know, the Microsoft at $3.1 trillion in market cap, creating $667 billion in annual cash flow versus the entire S&P energy sector at $1.6 trillion in market cap, throwing up $135 billion in cash flow. That's value. Right. And then I marvel at the energy sector being sort of 4% of the S&P's market cap, 4 or 5%. That is what makes everything run. That's the lubrication for every piece of food you eat, for your alarm clock glowing in the middle of the night, for the phone that's charging. All of it is coming from the energy sector, which is just so underweight from the perspective of what you should be concerned about if we do have a bit more of an inflationary pulse here. So, you know, that is a backdrop to the inflationary side of things and a nice exposure. I think, you know, you got 24% or so in the current portfolio in ZIG that's sort of energy focused. But as you say, it's a movable feast. Mm-hmm. I love that framing. So can you walk us through how you're seeing these screens? So you're screening these companies and you see that this buffet of value. And then how do you go through the process of allocating and sort of balancing off in the portfolio and then reviewing that? Because that's some magic that, hey, listen, you give me, you know, the magic formula. Here's a list of names. That's just a list of names. Do I equal weight? Do I have some, you know, sector awareness? What do I do there? And how do you attack that in the funds?
There's always a tension between maximizing the returns that you can generate over a long period of time and surviving. And so I always lean towards survival rather than maximizing returns. And so I've just philosophically taken that perspective, and that informs everything that we do. So the sector allocation is a good example of that, or the industry allocation. So it would be, if you were only interested in maximizing returns, you would maximize your exposure to the cheapest sector. But then you have this problem where sometimes, so an example would be for-profit colleges in the US. For-profit colleges were screened very, very cheaply at one period of time. And it was just before they all got put out of business by a few administrations ago in the States. So you need to be careful about being overly exposed, but equally you need to be exposed to the cheap sectors. So I have done a lot of testing and I found that you want to limit your exposure in some sense. I like to have about 20% of the portfolio would be the absolute maximum exposure to any given sector. And we limit the exposure in ZIG to, it's 30 positions. So they're 3%, 3.3% positions, reweighted back to equal weight every rebalance state. And I think that there's a lot of rebalancing alpha. You know, our mutual friend, Corey Hofstein, he's been very helpful to me in sort of thinking through a lot of those issues and timing luck and all of those sort of things. They are real impacts on the portfolio. And so I've worked a lot of that into the portfolio. So the question is always, you know, the criticism of value is, oh, you're just buying cheap things on a ratio basis. And that shouldn't work because it's too easy to implement. And I say, and that was sort of more, that argument was louder before September 2020, and it's gone away a little bit now, but it's still possible. It's so easy to find these things. Why would the alpha continue to exist?
10 years of massive underperformance.
That's right.
That'll shake a lot of people out. Tobacco 1999, baby.
Whatever's working is going to get a whole lot of attention, right? So, I think basically we have a cut. We can cut the universe down to an investable universe, and then in that investable universe, then I do this forensic diligence that we go through and we just make sure the financial statements actually match the economic reality of the businesses. Because when you look at an insurer or a bank, they're much, much harder to value and compare apples to apples with an oil company or a tech company or something like that. And commodities are different to industrials. There's a whole lot of little nuanced decisions that you have to make. And do you want the same 3.3% in Warrior Met Coal as you have in Facebook or Meta? So we bought Meta when it got cheap. Meta was another funny one where if I looked only at the financial statements, Meta seemed to me to be an absolutely spectacular company that was buying back stock, growing at a pretty good rate, and was very, very cheap. And I thought it was half price, kind of where we initiated the position was half price, and we bought it all the way down to one third of what I thought it was worth, with no view on whether it was going to turn around or not. Because the arguments on the other side were TikTok has this much better platform and all the kids are going to that, and it's just not able to compete with TikTok and it'll go the way of all of the other ones. And it was a compelling argument to me too when they made that. But I've also been in this game for long enough that I know that sometimes the narrative is not the truth, and you just put the position on and it sorts itself out a lot. It still wasn't right for the first 9 months or 12 months. It was hard to hold for that period of time, but it did turn around, and now it's high flying again and it's doing very well. And that's the nature of value. So there's always the tension between survival and optimization. And I think that survival is just my preference. And I've written a book now that it's not published yet, but that's the thrust of the book, is that in a game that has a risk of ruin, which is investing is a game with a risk of ruin, the sole focus has to be avoiding ruin, because that you truncate your long tail of performance if you go through ruin. And so you just have to avoid ruin first, and then you optimize for the set that sort of survives. And so that's the approach. It's always ruin avoidance first, secondarily performance.
And Toby, in terms of your approach, I mean, I think you've often said that the returns that you expect to earn from your investments are already baked in at the time of purchase, at the time of investment. And that goes to what you're just saying as well, right? I mean, that goes hand in hand with what the point you just made about avoiding ruin, which is that the returns are based on the price you pay.
Well, yeah, a little bit, but yeah, there's some ergodicity in there. Our friend Jason Buckle be happy that we're using that framing.
But, ergodicity.
Yeah, go ahead, Toby.
Luca Delana has a great book on. He's coined that phrase ergodicity, and he has the great book called Ergodicity, and he's a protege or something like that of Taleb. So they have that similar kind of approach, similar kind of idea. I really like that idea of ergodicity, and he makes that argument very compellingly in that book. And so I have used that as well. I think it's a great idea. Ruin avoidance is key, but the returns are baked in. So this is one of the funny things about, there's always this discussion. There's a little bit of tension between stock market operator type guys, like investor type guys, and business owner type investors. And so as much as I'm quantitative and I've been in the markets, I still think of these things as little businesses that we're buying. If you buy a business and they turn off the stock market, you still earn returns. Your returns are the same as they would be if the stock market was turned on. And it's sometimes hard for people to remember that. And I think that this is why value investors think that their strategy is evergreen, that every single position is going to work out, and why they think that it's evergreen. There's this argument that flows dominate and value, because it's not in the it's definitionally not in the big indexes, and they're smaller companies, so they don't get their fair share of the flows. And so therefore it's condemned to this corner of the market, and it'll never rise again. Value is done for good because everything's going to be in these big companies. They get all the flows. But as you point out, Pierre, that the returns are baked in when you buy, because you're still buying a little business. It's not, it doesn't really matter what the stock price does over the short period of time. And the example that I give is Dillard's, DDS. Mm-hmm. One of Buffett's deputies had a position in that, and he knew it fairly well, and he's confident in it. He sat in this thing for 7 years, which is a long period of time. And I similarly had bought and sold it over those 7 years, thinking this thing is crazy cheap, but it's retail, and there's a whole lot of problems with retail. And it never worked, and so I kept on selling out of it, and then I'd come back and buy back into it again. I missed the big run that Buffett's lieutenant got, which was where it went up 10 times in the course of 1 year. And so his compound return over its holding period, his internal rate of return, was 36% compounded per year. It's just that it all came in the last 12 months. And so I own Dillard's again now, having missed the run. So I mean, I shouldn't be giving this advice to anybody, because I'm a victim of the bad behavior that I'm about to decry, but you have to be sort of patient and sit in these things, and your return is baked in at the time that you buy, even if the stock price doesn't reflect that until this something crazy happens and you get the tenfold run in 1 year.
Yeah, that's crazy. I mean, the problem is sitting there while it does nothing.
Year after year, waiting
for the, you know, what you believe is inevitable to happen. And then, you know, and it goes on much longer. It can go on much longer than you anticipated as well.
Much longer.
That's the problem, is that, you know, you run out of steam.
Let's give a concrete example of this feedback loop that we're talking about that locks all these positions in. Let's go back to energy.
Hey.
In mid-2008, the S&P, 15% energy. Today, 4. Money goes where it's treated well to some degree, and then it gets really excited and pays too much for those few forward earnings at some point, and pays too little for other forward earnings. The banking sector was another one before, you know, the crisis in 2008, was a massive piece of the S&P pie, and shrunk dramatically. So this idea that there's this loop of constant feedback that always locks in the allocations across the sectors, and yes, there's money flows, but under the surface, there's still enough active investors around that money finds a way to find a place to where it's treated best. And by treated best, I mean has, you know, some expectation of future returns. And yes, sometimes that takes a little while because there's these divergences, right? And this is, I think this is, the 10-year divergence in valuation is a good divergence.
Well, part of the problem too is that what value is a risk-aware strategy. So you're trying to balance the return for the risk that you get. And one of the real risk that everybody, the academics all sort of, it's volatility. Let's all be honest. The real risk that we're worried about is a stock market crash where the market goes down 50%. Happened in 2000, happened in 2008. If you're levered, and you go through one of those, there's a good chance you get carted out feet first. So you have to be very, very careful. And there's just not been anything like that since 2007, 8, 9. You have to have, which means that you can be in your mid-30s as a portfolio manager and have never seen something of that scale, which is, you know, truly frightening, where everything you buy, you find these incredible bargains and buy them, and then they proceed down another 50% from where you buy them. You know, And that's the thing that keeps everybody honest. And we haven't seen that for a while in the market. When we see that, I mean, we saw 2020, but it was a flash crash. It was over so quickly. Nobody could really deploy capital. Buffett sort of sat there as an example. Like, when has Buffett ever not deployed into a big crash? And he sat there not deploying into that crash. I think the only thing he did was sell airlines through that period of time.
Right.
So the rest of us mere mortals can be forgiven also for not sort of deploying into that crash. And I don't think it was long enough for anybody to really get knocked out. I think that the next there's always one coming. It's just, I'm not making a prediction. It's just an iron law of the markets that there is a 50%.
Yeah.
There are multiple before the end of our careers. It's just going to happen. And you have to be able to survive those big crashes. And that's the thing that's the sort of blood at the base of the tree of liberty. That's the thing that keeps the whole thing going. We'll have one again at some point in the future. People will learn lessons and then we'll be at the other side.
The interesting thing too is that there's a few things there in the macro stage, right? You've got this inverted yield curve for what is kind of setting a record now Well, it is, unless you go back to 1928. Because in 1928, the 10-year was inverted compared to the 3-month for 20 months, and we're only at month 18. So as I like to say, the future always holds what the past has yet to reveal, right? Even if we go back through history, that doesn't mean that history is a complete guide of all the extremes that could occur. It is not, you know,
right.
that's a fact. So, you know, history can be a bit of a guide, but you know, the future holds what history is yet to reveal. And that's what that's kind of truly, as you said, you can't see the future. So we have this very long inverted yield curve. And what, you know, hearkening back to the 2000 era, if you owned the RSP or the S&P equal weight versus the cap weight, you did much better. And if you own small cap or small cap value, you actually did not see a 50% decline in your portfolio. You did have a long period of very moderate returns and a lot of suffering prior to the market cap weighted debacle, but you did not see a 50% decline. And I think it's a similar setup here that people should be starting to consider. You have pretty significant concentration. Yes, that can lead to some stuff, but there's this bulge of that where in 1998-99 it got concentrated and then did really well. So you have all the, you know, in the scatograph, you have all these points where, hey, it can do well, and never had done that before either in history. So it's a bit of fun. And again, it's just an opportunity to diversify to a truly unique set of returns. And if something hasn't done well in a decade and has had a lost decade, it gets more and more interesting.
I really like this idea of, you know, buying low and selling high, but I don't like the idea of buying, you know, great stocks that nobody wants to own.
Can you say more about that? What's a great stock that no one wants to own? I mean, definitionally, like as Toby said, all the stocks in the portfolio are cheap for a reason. Like it's probably a reason that you have to think through.
Well, I think Meta's
I was kidding, Mike.
But I think Meta's a genuinely good example of that because
you're absolutely right. That was a very difficult stock to want to get into after it got hammered.
If you only looked at the financial statements, which is basically what I'm doing, I really only look at the financial statements by virtue of the quantitative approach that I have and then the forensic accounting that we do at the end of that. But if I looked at the financial statements and I would just, here's a stock, I'm not going to tell you what it is, I'm just going to give you the quant version of it, the financial statement version of it, it was an easy buy. But if I discussed the name with anybody and I said that everybody said, it's obvious that TikTok is out there eating this thing's lunch. It's obvious that this thing is going to lose because the Reels isn't as good. And we're all sealed into this. We're on this, what's the movie where the two girls go over the cliff? We're in the car.
Thelma and Louise.
We're in Thelma and Louise and we're holding hands with Zuck as we go over the cliff as he's chasing the metaverse.
Yeah, that dalliance, multi-billion-dollar dalliance.
And it was real. He's spending $12 billion a year on service or something like that. Like it did look like nobody had any say. And so maybe people were
like he'd gone off his rocker or something, right?
Yeah. But so, then he came to his senses and he decided that he'd redirect it to buybacks. Metaverse has kind of quietly gone away.
And cutting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right size.
I mean, they got rewarded massively in the beginning of that rally for cutting, right? I mean, that was the turnaround.
And it's such a short period of time too. In the scheme of things, it's only a few years that all of this has sort of transpired through. But living through it day by day and moment by moment, it feels like a very long period of time.
Well, regrettably, you know, I missed out on that, and a whole lot of other stocks that could have done, you know, that did incredibly well for reasons that were very hard to determine. But, you know, again, coming back to what you said, Toby, which is that if you just look at the company at the financials, you get a completely different perspective.
It's not necessarily the right perspective either. I am conscious of that, that there are some...
But it's not emotional. It's not based on the hearsay and the scuttlebutt that's going around about whether or not Mark Zuckerberg is off his rocker, or, you know, what has he done? What's he doing? He's gone crazy.
It's the classic quantitative decision making. I believe this was covered in, you know, the little book that beats the market, where he had those who subscribed to his service and selected from his picks versus auto execution of the picks into a portfolio. The auto execution of the picks into the portfolio outperformed the S&P substantially. Those picking the stocks that they wanted through their own wetware screen underperformed the S&P. Right?
You inevitably cherry pick out the best ones.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. You're going to like, it's obvious TikTok is not going to do that one. Like, TikTok's going to eat bad as lunch. I can't do that one. And, you know, that's often where the returns come from. And that's an example of that, you know, that story. I bastardized it a little bit, but, you know, your wetware overlay is probably not helpful.
The challenge is
like the Dalbar survey does that as well, right? I mean, it points out the fact that, you know, while the S&P 500 did 15%, the average investor in it, you know, did 7%.
Yeah. And it's very common.
Because, you're trading.
You find lots of examples of funds that have done very, very well over a period of time. And that CGM focus fund, Ken Huebner's fund, was manager of the decade, had the best performance. They were like 15%, something like that, compound over a period, long period of time. Average investor in the fund, cash on cash returns were negative 11% per year. Because they bought it when it did well and they sold it when it did badly. Yeah. And they should have been doing the opposite.
Exactly.
It's probably a recent announcement or a recent experience that rhymes with snark.
Another good example. The funny thing is there are so many, you can find that fund in every single bubble. So it was Janus, and then in the go-go years, you know, I'm blanking on the names a little bit now, but there's always that person always exists where nobody can really describe their strategy other than to say they're just in the hot stuff. They've got the hot hand. They're picking the stuff that really works. And then once it goes away, which it seems to inevitably happen, they return. The returns are very ordinary. And snark as a theoretical example is a good one where you look at prior to and after, and it's crazy that just they caught lightning in a bottle for that period of time. That's life-changing for them, but it's tough for all the investors.
Yeah. So changing gears a little bit, Toby, because we're coming up on an hour, just thinking through, so we've talked about the funds, we've talked about, you've got a new book coming. Have you got a title for it yet? Is it going to be on pre-release? Can we look in Amazon and pre-buy it? Or is it a kind of, you know, still a ways in the distance?
So the book is called Invincible, and because that's the pinnacle of survival is invincibility, perfect survival. And I've been a long-term fan of Buffett, obviously, and I've read all of his letters and absorbed them all. I've also tried to read Sun Tzu's Art of War. I read it in high school. I read it every 5 years since I left high school, and I've never really got it. It was very much a... Emperor's New Clothes. You know, I didn't get what everybody else saw in this silly book. And I read it through the pandemic in about 2020. And just for the first time, it clicked a little bit. I read it really deeply. And I thought, it's crazy how close his prescriptions are to Graham's and to Buffett's. If you apply Sun Tzu to the stock market, or you apply Buffett to sort of grand strategy, you get... They're sort of talking about the same thing. And the most important one is the ergodicity. That's a strong theme through both Graham, Buffett, and Sun Tzu. And then there's other things too. So Sun Tzu talks about this idea of the following the moral law, which is the way, which is the Taoist idea of the way. But ultimately, it boils down to the same thing, because these books were all written out of war, and the Lao Tzu's book about the Tao, and these other books, they're all written at the same time. They're sort of this, the birth of like liberal ideas about, you know, the way that you should conduct yourself through the world. And the idea of adhering to the moral law, Sun Tzu says you should adhere to the moral law because that's what causes your men to follow you and put themselves in danger, and the people will sacrifice and be behind you. And I think that Buffett has been very good. He's very clear about that. He talks about that all the time. He talks about reputation being very important, character, his own personal reputation being very important. So he'll never do anything that will injure his reputation, build it up over an entire lifetime, and you can destroy it in 5 minutes. But he also mm-hmm. says when he hires, he looks for people who've got energy, because if they don't have energy, they're not going to get anything done. They need some intellect because they need to be smart enough to do what they're going to do. But then he says if they need the character. And if they don't have character, then the other two will kill you. The energy and the intellect will kill you. So you need to make sure they've got the character. And it's funny how often, every time they're interviewed, they say, you know, how do you find these great managers? And he says, you know, it's basically it's character. And it's funny, the longer that I have been in business, the people who I have seen fall along the wayside have typically been people who have sort of lacked that, you know, had that character issue. You know, Martin Shkreli is a good example of that, right? So Shkreli, clearly very, very intelligent guy, clearly very high energy. And he's done this thing that has offended so many people that the government has gone after him. And ultimately they've convicted him, not of the thing that offended everybody, but, you know, it's like getting the mobster for tax evasion. It's that they got him for what they could get him for. And I think that that's, you know, and you could call that karma, or you could call it like, it is what it is. It's, if you offend people enough, they will find a way to get you. And that pattern of behavior where you go around injuring people all the time, it comes back to bite you eventually. And so I think the character is very important. So I talk about that a little bit in the book. And I think that that's something that Buffett has talked about. And that's something that Sun Tzu has talked about. And the book is just finding the parallels between the two. Right. And there are many, I think.
Yeah. And the Tao Te Ching of Lao Tzu is the Lao Tzu book you're talking about.
Thank you, yeah.
Yeah. Both books I do love. And I suppose there's, what's the other one? The five rings, or the five circles too?
Oh, the five rings. Yeah.
The five rings is sort of in that ilk, but,
Musashi Miyamoto.
Yeah.
So that's, I also include that in the book because I think that he has drawn heavily from Lao Tzu,
yes.
or the other.
Yeah.
And there's also one more. There's the Zhuangzi, which was written about the same time, which is this. He just tells it through stories, and the stories are phenomenal. And
I'm going to have to look that up. I haven't been familiar with that.
I stole a couple of the stories because they illustrate the ideas so well. One of them is, and I don't want to go too far into the book, but that one of them is that just you find that there are easier ways of doing things, and you should do these things in the easiest possible way of doing them, rather than if you find that you're getting a whole lot of, you know, if it's incredibly difficult. And for value investors, I think value investors love these incredibly mm-hmm. complex, convoluted valuations that you need to be deep inside it to understand how it's going to work, when often the simplest thing is the best. That's why I think it's okay to buy something that's cheap on a ratio basis, because, you know, it can easily get expensive on a ratio basis too. Yeah. These things wiggle around a little bit. So that's the approach. The book is a little bit of fun. It's not meant to be too serious, but I enjoyed writing it, and it'll be out soon.
Love
it's
it.
Finished. It's just getting reviewed.
Well, we'll have to have you back on the various stuff when you do the release too, and we can dig into it some more. But yeah, thank you for the early look. We got the early steal here.
Yeah.
I have another question, Pierre, but do you have anything on your
Go
mind?
Go ahead.
I'm just wondering on the podcast too, have you, what's been some of your most enlightening guests over the last year? Any takeaways from running your, I guess it's a video, it's on YouTube and whatnot. I love it. You kind of go live and you talk value stocks and whatnot. I just love the format, but anything that any insights you've gleaned from that, either from the marketing side or from the value side, any favorite guests and stuff, like what are you thinking from that space?
Yeah, many, many. It's been great because I think it's important to talk to other people in your industry who are doing similar things to get their perspective on things. And I take ideas from the things that people say, and I go back and I test them, and it has resulted in some changes to my portfolio or changes to the strategy over time. So that's been very helpful. I always love chatting to people like Chris Bloomstrand. He's a value investor who's been running his value portfolio for 25 years publicly, writing a very long letter every year. So he's great. He's deep in that. He's close to Buffett, deep in that sort of thought process. And then, you know, I get the Seawolf boys on. They're the, do you know the Seawolf boys? They were featured from The Big Short. They're two of the guys who are in The Big Short. Yeah. And they're great because they've got a really different view. Like it's easy to find a lot of mainstream views. It's hard to find the really divergent views. And so they're quite bearish, and, you know, they're very much anti the current structure of politics and the way that we conduct ourselves and the Fed and all that sort of stuff. But they're still long, you know, they're long only. They're not long only, they're long, and they'll buy stuff. And so you can sort of work through their reasoning and then they'll be long something. And I kind of like that. I like that approach. They're fun. So those are really standouts for me.
Love it. Love it.
Toby, thank you so much. That was terrific. That was a terrific conversation. And thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time and insight.
Oh, thank you, Pierre. It's been an absolute pleasure. I love chatting to you. Love chatting to Mike. Good to see you again.